This is an interview with Daniel S. Opencar for the Youngstown State University Oral History Department by Dale J. Voitis at 3300 White Beach Lane on 27 October 1982 at 7:45 p.m. Okay, Uncle Danny, tell me something about your childhood and your family as it you grew up in Youngstown.
Well, my childhood was rather typical of my generation because my parents were immigrants. We lived in a little ghetto-like where we all spoke a common language, mine which was Romanian. When I went to school, I couldn't even speak English. I could only speak Romanian. So I had to go to kindergarten to learn to speak English. And I progressed through school. And we moved quite a bit here and there due to circumstances, money, jobs. So I attended quite a few different schools in my life. But we finally ended up back in Youngstown, and I graduated from Grant High School in 1934. And then I got a job at, got my first job at the Isley Dairy Company. And I worked there for, I worked there until the draft came. And when the draft started, I enlisted in the draft. And through some unfortunate family happening, I went to the Army much sooner than I expected. In fact, I enlisted in the Army because the problems were such I felt that was the solution to the problem. And that's how I got into service.
Okay. Well, that goes into my second question. And, in other words, explain then, you enlisted in the draft, but then was your number called, or did you actually go down and say, I want to join, or how was that? How did that come about?
No, my draft number was, I was lucky I had a good draft number, and I had a, from the job I had a deferment. So I went down and enlisted in the United States Army. And from there I was drafted, and then we went to camp in Alabama, Fort McClellan, to do basic infantry training. I stayed there for about 3 months, and then from there we went to Camp Hood, Texas, for tank and armor division, and we stayed there for about 6 months, and then we finally transferred to Fort Dix, and we stayed there for about 2 months, I believe, and we were shipped overseas.
Okay, tell me a little bit about what basic was like then. I mean, how many people were you together in a barracks, or I mean, what was it like? I mean, you know, in the morning, or you know, was there a lot of people there? I mean, or
I thought basic training in Alabama was horrible. We were out in a boondocks where all we had was tent city, bunch of tents, and there was.
There was no wooden barracks, it was just tents?
Well, we weren't attached to the wooden barracks. We was out in the field in the tents. And they had, it was all clay, red clay, mud, bugs. And the weather, it was in the summertime, and the weather was terrible. It was hot. And we had quite a problem of adjusting to the heat and to the bugs.
Okay. You said you went to Camp Hood for tank training. What kind of vehicles were those? Do you remember what kind of tanks you trained in? Or?
Well, the first tanks we had were them old, I don't know what they called, General Grants or whatever they were. They had a...
Grants.
And then after that we got the tanks with the 76 millimeter rifles. And we trained on... And we trained on them in the flats and in the woods and up and down the hills. And the thing I remember the most, we had a young lieutenant one time, and our company. He said that don't be afraid to drive these tanks. They can take a lot of abuse. Well, he said this to the wrong group of people. We were all from the north, we were used to cars, we were used to driving, and when he said that, it was like giving us a green light. I think by the end of that day, we ruined more equipment than they had for quite a long time. And in fact, the commander, or the next in command, said he never seen a bunch of people acting so crazy like we did with this big, heavy equipment.
Okay. What were the background of some of the soldiers that you were with? Were they, like you said, maybe they were from the north, or were they from the south, or you know, their education backgrounds? Why did they get in, and things like that?
Well, most of the fellows I went in, we had about half from the north, and half of them were from the south, but they came from the bigger cities, and they were, I'd say, a little better educated, more knowledgeable. In fact, I think this company I went in with was all enlisted men, and at that time they would separate the enlisted men and the draftees, so they were a little tougher on us because we enlisted in the Army. They kept telling us, well, if you didn't want it, why'd you enlist? Why'd you get here? They were pretty knowledgeable, but the thing was, the weather again was so horrible, the flies and the bugs, and then we used to live out in the field.
Was it like living in the field at Camp Hood too, or did you get some wooden barracks there?
No, it was just as bad in Camp Hood, because they'd send us out. First we went through what they called, guerrilla training, infiltration. That was mostly all on foot at night, running up and down hills before we got to run the equipment. And so we were always outside sleeping on the ground, and we got infected with bugs, and the food wasn't all that good. And with the flies and the conditions, most of the time had diarrhea. Mm. They used to have big open mess kitchens out in the field, and of course you couldn't keep the flies away.
Did you get any free time on the weekends or at night? Did you get a chance to like see any movies, or did you mostly play cards, or how would you say
well,
you relaxed?
I would say the first 4 or 5 weeks you were so doggone tired you didn't want to go anywhere. As soon as you got time off, if you got back to camp, you take a shower and you lay down and go to sleep. But then after a while, when they were slacking off on our training, they would give us a pass. We could go into town, and that most of the towns there were nothing but a four-lane crossroad. There's nothing there anyway. They didn't even have a beer garden, no shows. So consequently, everybody would either gamble or get together, sing songs.
Did you have to spend any holidays that you remember in your training, like Easter or Christmas, or away from your family?
Well, I think the first Christmas I was home, because I'm still in the States. But then the next three Christmases I was overseas, so I couldn't get home. That was the hardest part, holidays. Even when I came back, when I came back for the holidays, it's such a great emotional experience getting your bag and going back. You didn't mind coming home, but going back was the hard part.
Yeah, I'll bet. What kind of pay was it like then, as far as, do you remember what you were actually making?
Oh, when I first went in, we got $1 a day, I think, $30 a month. Then we were in it for about three or four months, and then they raised it to, I forget what it was, $50, $60, or $90.
Well, that was a big raise.
Yeah, and then they made allowances for your family. You could send money home, and they would, then they had like health and welfare, insurance, and I think at that time we got $10,000 life insurance.
Okay, after Fort Dix, where did your career take you? Where did you end up?
After that?
Explain the where, all, just in relation to where you went, and we'll ask other questions later about what you did.
Thinking back, it's a little kind of fuzzy there. There's another place, but I can't seem to fit it in there. I do know we ended up at Fort Dix. We were shipping out. By then we had no equipment. All of it was gone. And all we had was our uniforms and
we're just waiting for the ships.
Duffel bag, and we was waiting to get shipped out. Now I know we were supposed to, I think they took our equipment and loaded it on ships, our armored equipment and loaded it on ships, and we were supposed to go to North Africa. But in the meantime, at North Africa, the campaign was running so strongly against us that they lost so much equipment that they took our equipment to resupply the troops there, and consequently we had to wait in Fort Dix a little longer until they could reassemble new equipment or new direction that we were supposed to go. And that was, I think we were in Fort Dix for about 3 months because we were hung up with no equipment.
When was this, what date and time? Like 42?
It would have to be, I would say the fall and winter of 42. Because I think the Allies were taking a beating in North Africa. And they had to send all our equipment down there that was already loaded. And we were supposed to pick up when we got there. So consequently, our plans were canceled. So we sat idle at Fort Dix for 3 months, 90 days.
Did you get a chance to see your family then, or were you kind
of... Yes. I used to get home on weekends then. Seems to me I could get home on a weekend, but I'd be late for Monday morning
reveille.
So consequently, I was always in the doghouse. Every time I'd come home, I'd get back late, and I'd have to...
KP or...?
Well, a lot of times it was KP or in a brig. I remember one time in particular, we had motorcycles. So I come back late to camp as usual, and he made me push the motorcycle around a doggone compound about 8 times as punishment because I was late for, I missed reveille.
Missed reveille.
Yeah.
Okay, what was, if you remember, what was your unit designation? What kind of a unit was it? Or do you know the number, like 100 and so-and-so? Or, I mean, do you know what kind of a unit it was? And
yeah, we got a unit designation. We were called up 803rd Tank Destroyer Battalion. And I was, and at that time I was in one of the companies. But anyway, I eventually ended up in Recon Company because I couldn't stand the being enclosed in one of the big tanks. I'd much rather take my chances and be outside than ride one of the big iron things.
Okay, and 803rd Tank Destroyer was attached to what higher units? Was it attached to an armored division and part of a certain army, or?
Well, we were usually unattached, and wherever they needed more firepower, for instance, or our biggest job was reconnaissance. We do what they call reconnaissance in force. And later on, we found this out. First, we'd go out, and then the tank companies would come up. They'd come up behind us from information we'd send back, or battalion, or corps, or whatever. And then it would depend on how much resistance we encounter, how they would commit the bulk of their armored forces. So consequently, we were always moving around. I think we stayed the longest with Patton's 3rd Army.
Okay. After Fort Dix, you didn't go to North Africa. Did you go to England then?
Yeah, after Fort Dix, then we finally ended up in England. But we still didn't have any equipment in England. And so we was there for, I'd say 3 or 4 months, more or less, spit and polish, training, maneuvers, landing off of LSTs, played football, basketball, and the food was terrible at that time because the German submarine were so active that we had to live off of British rations.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and we couldn't get American rations, and everybody lost a lot of weight. We got skinny, and what the heck was one of the things we had to eat? I had a kidney stew. Kidney pie, they called. And it would come in cans. And I was one of the few guys that could eat it. Because I had been used to eating that stuff from when I was a young fella.
Yeah. Did you travel across in a convoy then? It was a ship?
Yes, we went across in a big... Well, when we left England, we went... it was a huge convoy. I think it was a steady stream of boats from England to France, and it depended, we was about, I'd say halfway out in the channel when they would organize the attacking force from whatever group they wanted to hit the beach, or who was best able to hit the beach, the weather.
And when would you say your unit went ashore? Right on D-Day, or a certain couple of days afterwards? Yeah. Or?
Now, we were scheduled to go in on D+3, but we did make the D+3. A couple of our units got ashore, then the weather went bad. So we pulled back and laid offshore. We didn't go until, I'd say, about probably D+14, till the weather cleared. I think they built a dock or a floating dock or something that they could unload supplies and ammunition. The bottleneck was ammunition. They had enough. Equipment.
Soldiers.
There. Yeah. It's just that. So when we landed, I think we had a beachhead about 2 miles wide. I think about maybe a mile in depth, off a Omaha beachhead.
Omaha. Okay, then. Basically, being attached to. With Patton's third, you were involved in that. You were traveling pretty fast then, as far as getting across France. If you were with his unit.
When we first went in, like I said, the front was only about a mile in depth, and we pulled up behind a 155 battery, because the place was so crowded with equipment and GIs that we couldn't move, and we were right there. And I remember when the first barrage of 155s went off. Well, I think everybody in the whole place got scared. We almost ready to
change your mind.
Yeah, change your mind and go back. But the problem was mobility. And in that part of the country, they had what they called hedgerows. The farmers would make a big hedgerow around each one of their little plot of ground that was theirs. It was like a fence. But they were made out of stone, dirt, brush, trees, and they'd been there for centuries. And the only way you could really get over them was you'd have to use the infantry and just attack one at a time. And they even used the 105s, and they would pull them up to the front line and file point blank at the next hedgerow or two hedgerows over as a weapon. They even tried putting these big blades on tanks, and they would charge the hedgerow and punch a hole in it. But that wasn't very successful either, because the Germans would fire their bazookas and they would knock the tanks out. So the only way they could really do it was they would have to bring the 105s and fire point blank, and right after that they would just jump over and take off. At that time there was mostly airborne troops there. Mm. And they would just jump over the hedgerow, take one hedgerow at a time, the hard way.
Well, then your unit really wasn't deployed then. You were just kind of waiting until something happened then for a while.
Yeah, we were waiting until they would get breakthrough so they could maneuver the equipment around and attack the enemy. The way we were sitting there now, all we were doing was gathering information, going around to the various CPs, finding out. But honestly, you couldn't even walk. It was that close and that in him together. Hmm. And there was always a constant artillery barrage going out, coming in. It'd be hard to tell, but it's amazing after a while how you could tell by your ear how close it was going to hit. Mm-hmm. If it hit more than 25 feet away, you wouldn't even duck, and you would know it.
Just keep walking. Did you ever have to worry about German airplanes? I mean, was that something that you just kind of forgot about, or?
Well, initial stage, they were there in strength. And I think a lot of there was a tremendous amount of anti-aircraft batteries there, and plus we had good air support from our own. They would fly over from at that time I think they hadn't established an airfield yet, and they would fly over from, I imagine, England, which is the closest place, and we had pretty strong. And then of course the Navy was off the beat. And the Navy would also lob big shells in there. And you can hear them suckers coming in too.
Okay. Then you, after you kind of waited for the big breakthrough, and when that happened, then you were attached with Patton, and you kind of did a lot of fast moving
around. Yeah, finally, I think
that was in the fall. Then.
Yeah, they finally punched and punched till they got enough room to maneuver enough so they could get like a big springboard, and they had a big aerial attack at one time, It was prearranged where they're going to punch a corridor 2 miles wide and 7 miles long. That was after we cleared hedgerows where we could maneuver. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, they had every aircraft they could get a hold of. They dropped the bombs and we poured through that opening. So we was in that opening and we got through the first end, and that's where we stopped for the night. Mm-hmm. We held up to see if it was going to hold. So we didn't know whether it was going to be prisoners or what till the next day come around. So, because we all dug in and waited to see if they could protect this corridor, because the Germans were going to counterattack, and they did. And but it held, and that was the hole that gave us that we all poured through that. And then we stayed there and we watched the equipment rumble too for about maybe a week or so. You know, he's on this one side, this one post, and all we had to do was make sure it stayed clear. Of course, we'd run a big round circular perimeter around to see nothing else happen. And I never see so much armored equipment pour through here in all my life. Day and night, one right after the other, truck after truck, tank after tank, and all kinds of support equipment, artillery, and all it takes to keep the movement going. And after that, it became a lot more fluid.
Yeah,
yeah, we weren't pinned down as much as we were down on the beachhead. So,
how close did your unit ever come to Paris, or?
We never did get to Paris. We went on our territory. We went on the outskirts of Paris.
Mm-hmm.
So I never did get to Paris, but we could see the Eiffel Tower when we was going through.
Oh, really? You went by that close?
But yeah, by the time we went around Paris, I'd say the biggest part of the fighting was done. It was over. The Germans were demoralized, and it wasn't as tough, you know, you weren't as scared. Although, you know, it could always happen. And I remember one incident we had when we were with Patton. We pulled all the way up to the Siegfried line. That's when Patton ran out of gas. They wouldn't give him ammunition. And we could see it. And there it was. But for some reason or other, we had to pull back. And we did pull back. And I'd say months later, when we came up to the same position, we could still see some of our forward equipment that was knocked up. Mm. That if they would have, of course I don't understand the logistics, but if Eisenhower would have reinforced Patton, he would have been through that Siegfried line right then before the Germans had a chance.
That was in the fall of 44 then.
Yeah.
Before the winter set in.
Mm-hmm. So then we wintered in the Hurtgen Forest.
What was winter like?
It was terrible. We was right in the woods. And the weather was cold, everything, bitter cold.
It's pretty static then, you just...
Yeah, we were in a static position because in the wintertime, you couldn't do much fighting, you couldn't do much of anything, because nobody really wanted to do a hell of a lot except stay alive and not freeze to death. You would try to keep warm or wherever you was at. If you was lucky enough to get in an old farmhouse or old barn or something, you'd build a little fire to keep warm. And if the farmer had any chickens or something, they were prize game. I remember one thing we used to do, we used to loot the farmer's cellars. Some of the fellas used to get the alcoholic beverages, we used to get the canned goods and canned meats and eat them.
How did the farmers do about that?
Well, they weren't there. Usually when we'd approach a town or something,
they
would all
desert.
The population would immediately desert the town. They'd probably go in the woods or somewhere else. But there was absolutely nobody there, and I can't say I blame them, because sometimes if we would meet any resistance, the artillery barrage is horrendous. They just level everything down.
Okay, what kind of people were you with now? I mean, were these the same guys you had done training with, or I mean, what were these guys, what were your buddies like? Develop some close relationships?
Especially in my platoon, we developed a very strong relationship. We were very good friends because we lived together. And in fact, for all we know, some of us thought we might even die together. And we got to be quite friendly. We were together for about 3 years. And I'd say it was like a family. I know when somebody got hurt or somebody had to go back for medical attention or something, we would miss them and we'd inquire what happened to them. Or if somebody got killed. I remember one time one of our fellows got killed and I had to write a letter home. I didn't want to write it, but the the officer said I was the only one that could write it, so I did. And it was a terrible thing to do. I didn't know what the hell to say. Patriotism, country, doing what's right. But he was gone.
How was letters from home? Did you get communication often, or was it kind of like a whole bunch at one time, or was it kind of spaced out? Or did you get like regular mail? Or
I would say the mail service was excellent. They really tried, and we got mail mostly in bunches or clumps, whatever we'd pull back to a staging area or something like that. But it wasn't unusual to have them deliver the mail right up to where we were stationed, right up to the front line. Or you couldn't say it was exactly a front line because it was a fluid situation. It was come and go. There was no static positions. If the enemy came and we couldn't hold them, we'd back off, or vice versa. And at night, everybody would dig in and stay put because you didn't know who they were.
Not too much activity at night then?
No, very little. The only thing at night was maybe foot patrols, but there wasn't even too much of that. Or if there was, I never saw them. Because sometimes we were really stretched out for, maybe our zone was a couple of hundred yards, 500 yards, and there's no way you could patrol all of that. You'd patrol your own immediate little area, wherever vehicle you was in, or whatever group we was in, because we never had dug in, you know, like they dug in with machine guns and rifles. No, we were all more or less fluid, and we would be able to move.
Okay, how did you feel about the... Did you feel you were adequately supplied as far as like when the winter came? Did you have, did you get warm clothing and gloves and boots and that kind of stuff right away? How did you feel about the supply situation? Did you get what you wanted or what you needed to do what you had to do?
Well,
you had to wait?
I think that we had to wait. There wasn't, it didn't come, you know, as soon as you wanted. But I think they tried, and we did get adequate clothing, coats. The hardest part to get was rubber boots, because when you got a pair like they were them rubber overshoes, you pull over your combat boots, because by then we needed all big sizes because we had big shoes on, so you'd have to get big boots. So usually when you got a pair, you hung on to them. But I would say all in all, yes, they did a good, the supply corps did a good job. Food, rationing, ammunition, mail. Yes, I was satisfied.
Okay, what was your, maybe you had different things you had to do, but what was your particular job assignment? What were your, today they've got radio men and they've got specific jobs in the Army. What was your job at that time? Do you know what I mean? I mean, maybe you had to do a couple different things. Tell me what you had to do.
Well, most of the time, I'd say the biggest part of the time, we'd get a map and we'd have to go out in a certain area. Maybe there was a Ford OP there or a village or whatever, woods, stream, or maybe we just had to run a road down to see if it was passable for tanks, for instance, if there was bridges. And most of the times they would send out a convoy, maybe an armored car, and maybe two or three Jeeps. And I would ride in the Jeep as assistant driver, and we would radio back.
Say, this area is clear, or this is okay?
This is clear, but most of the times that wasn't even necessary to radio back. We were working in such a big group that if something happened or something we thought we should tell back, the radio operator in the armored car would call back and tell them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I did that job for a while too, and I didn't care for that either. So I ended up as assistant driver in a Jeep because you're right out there in the open. If something would happen, you get the hell out of there. But in one of them big armored cars, you're stuck in there.
Mm-hmm. Do you like those Jeeps then?
Yes, I think so.
Good piece of equipment?
They were good, tough, rugged, and they seemed to take a lot of abuse. The tires, they seemed to go forever. Never ran out of gasoline, and I don't remember ever adding much oil to the engines.
Did you have to do some of your own maintenance then on it?
Not really, no. No, because most of the times we'd pull back to the motor pool, and they would change oil and grease them or weld them or repair them or whatever had to be done. And I don't think we ever lost any Jeeps. We always managed to bring them back. Of course, some of them, you know, they would get, maybe they would get shelled or they run over a mine or something like that. And they were wrecked.
How were you armed yourself, what kind of weapon, did you carry any weapons or what?
Yeah, we had a, what they call an M30 carbine, and it was full automatic, but it wasn't much good because they weren't very accurate. They would hit nothing anyway. So, fortunately, we never had to use them, but some of the fellows picked up other arms.
Oh, yeah, just whatever they felt they...
Yeah, of course, there was no problem. You could pick up anything you wanted. M1 rifles were always... You could always pick it up. I mean, M1 rifle, they were laying off. And when that, I should recap that. So you go in a battle area, and you follow the infantry, because usually they're there. And then after you follow the infantry, there's all kind of loose weapons laying around. And usually somebody would get, like, M1 rifles and pile them up on the stack. An ordnance comes through later and picks them up, picks them back, and reuse them. Like machine guns, light machine guns. And you could always find hand grenades or laying around. And then there was a lot of German equipment, too, laying around. Guns.
Was there any
hand grenades?
Any souvenir hunters, or were guys just seen it so many times it didn't mean anything to them? Or?
Oh, yeah, there was souvenir hunters. Revolvers was a thing, German Lugers, and P-48s. And of course, German flags, and that's about all you could carry, because anything you picked up, you had to carry it.
Yeah.
And fortunately, we had vehicles, but if you were on foot, everything you owned was on your back.
Do you ever think that that stuff might be as, that you saw then, could be as valuable as it is today?
Not really, I didn't think so. I thought maybe, like, you'd get a swastika flag and hang it up in your room as a memento or something like that. But we saw a lot of wrecked German equipment, their artillery pieces, cars. And I never saw so much wrecked equipment. Like we were on one pincer move of the fillet gap where the German equipment, most of the German equipment got through, but a lot of it didn't get through.
And
you could see down the road burned out equipment laying. One time I picked up a motorcycle, a German motorcycle, and
what were you going to do with it?
It was in running condition. I'm trying to think the driver, where the heck he was. But anyway, the motorcycle was laying in the ditch, so I picked it up and kicked it over, and it started. So he's running convoy, and I was riding the motorcycle up and down, and you know they don't sound like an American motorcycle. Mm-hmm. So the company commander maybe get rid of it.
Okay, see, what would you say, what would be, we talked a little bit about this already, you know, as far as what you did, but what was a typical day like? Like, what time did you get up in the morning, and was chow regular, or is it just when you catch as catch can, or, you know, when did you knock off, is that regular, or is it just, what was it like on a typical day?
A typical day, we were mostly on dry rations, I think what they call 10-in-1. Where you had various components, canned goods, cigarettes, chocolate bars. And they had a chocolate bar there that was loaded with vitamins and stuff. And that's what we used to live on most of the time. Because you'd carry them in your pocket. If you eat one of them, you wouldn't get hungry. And we had canned goods. They had little tins of food and crackers. And we'd stick them in our pocket. Most of the times we would eat out in the field whenever you had time, whenever the weather was right, or you couldn't steal nothing, you'd eat your own rations. And as I didn't smoke, I used to give the cigarettes away. The cigarettes came with the rations. But we were mostly on dry rations. And then occasionally when we'd pull back or to a rear area, our kitchen would come up and we'd get a hot meal. That wasn't too often, though. Most of the times, unless we pulled back for a rest for about 3 days, 4 days a week, then we get all new clothes, take a shower, get meals. They were good at that, by giving you new clothes. You take your old clothes out, they weren't exactly new, but they were laundry, they were clean, they were mended, if they needed it, and then you would get all the new clothes to wear.
What did you, was it, your day started at sunup, or did you?
Well, the day would start, yes, I would say, when the daylight would begin, when the sun would start coming up, that's when it would start. In fact, you wouldn't really know when it would stop, because if you was in a forward position, you'd always have to be listening or watching. Somebody would always have to be awake, and we usually take turns. You know, somebody would be awake all the time. And if you hear something or see something or get a message, why, he would wake up the rest of the people. I remember one time we almost blew a cow away. That cow never did know. He woke us all up and we could hear him, you know. We could hear him crunching in the woods. And the reason we did fire because we was afraid to give our position away. Yeah. So we kept waiting and waiting and waiting. And finally the cow comes out of the woods.
That's probably scarier than most because it didn't have any purpose to it. And it was just wandering aimlessly.
The Germans probably chased it away from their position because they weren't too far away. We could hear their vehicles.
Oh, really?
At night. We could hear their tanks maneuvering. And that's why we didn't open fire, because I knew as we would, we'd have a firefight. And another thing, whenever we'd pull in a position with our heavy equipment, the infantry people used to pull out because they couldn't stand that big fire, because we'd attract big fire. We were shooting 76 millimeter at them, they would shoot 98 millimeters back at us. And so they would usually leave. They'd go somewhere else.
Okay. Now, we got you up to the Siegfried Line. You went through the winter. What did your unit, after the springtime came, where did you go across the Rhine?
We went across the Rhine on Pontoon Bridge. We went down, it was a pontoon bridge we went across. We finally went through the Siegfried Line. I'm trying to think what the heck. They had a counterattack in there someplace.
Oh yeah, the Bulge.
Because we pulled into Luxembourg for a rest. And we just no sooner got there, and we got our equipment out, than we had to throw our stuff back in the vehicles and move out again. Because that's when they had the Battle of the Bulge. And I think they wiped out two of our companies. It was their turn, and we pulled back for a rest. And I know they wiped out one company when the Battle of the Bulge started, because they were right there, and they were overrun before they knew what happened. So we pulled back up to the front, and it was a heck of a mess. Nobody seemed to know what the hell anybody was doing. They was asking questions. Nobody would believe anything. And I would think that a lot of probably American boys got shot by mistake. They wouldn't trust nobody. And everything was so mixed up. But they attacked us with such a force and so quick that I heard they punched a pretty big hole in the line.
What was everybody's reaction to that? Were they mad, or was it just, oh boy, or you know, kind of thoughts went through your mind at that time? You're probably hoping you were going to get home, and all of a sudden
I think it was a disappointment, because like you say, everybody thought that the end was near. We had them on a run, and we didn't think they had that much force or that many people left to mount a counterattack. Because after the winter, we'd taken some pretty big jolts. The weather alone, I think we had more casualties from the weather than the enemy.
Up until that time.
Yeah, because they used to go around and say, if you can't feel your feet, you're in trouble. But as long as they're hurting, you know you're all right.
Okay, then after the book, you were doing a lot of heavy fighting in the Bulge time.
We were doing a lot of, I would say, we were probably using our tanks for artillery pieces, doing indirect fire. Because we were mobile, we were fast, and we were right there before the support equipment would be able to come up. Plus the fact they didn't know where the enemy was at. Mm-hmm. They had no definite lines, and they had to get whatever they had. I know there for a while that ammunition was a problem, and they burned up a couple of these tanks from firing so hard. See, and another thing that I remember when we, just before we went through the Siegfried Line one time, just the first time we came up there, approached the Siegfried Line, we were running out of gas, and one of our missions was run a big round perimeter about 2 or 5 miles, I forget, and the C-47 cargo planes were flying, and as they were taxiing along the road, they would throw out 5 gallons of cans of gasoline. And that's what we were doing. We're going round and round.
Just these protecting them.
Yeah, and these T-47 would come in and throw the gas out. Of course, there are other people there, take the gas away, whatever.
Hmm. OK. Okay, after the Balds, then you got across the Rhine. How far did you go into, you know, how far did you travel into Germany, or, you know, where did you end up, like, when the war was over?
We ended up in Czechoslovakia.
Czechoslovakia.
Yeah. We went through Germany, started to go through the Balkan countries, and at that time they told us we were going to meet up with the Russians. I forget the name of the town, but we did meet up with the Russians in Czechoslovakia.
Oh, you met some Russians
there? Yeah. Mm-hmm. In fact, we met an airborne division from the Russians, and we met them. Of course, and then one day, I don't know if it was before or after we met the Russians, they told us the war was over. Hmm. And boy, everybody felt good. They came out of the foxholes. They would build fires, and they would walk around, and they quit hiding, and they wouldn't care where they parked the vehicles. Before, used to park everything out of the way, or throw something on it, or hide it, or something like that. Then we found out the war was over, and we finally met the Russians, and they were a sorry lot.
Really? I was going to ask you, how long were you exposed to them? What were your impressions?
About two or three days.
What were your impressions of them?
My impression, for instance, they were paratroopers, they were smaller. I'd say the average paratrooper was about 5 foot tall, 5'1". They were smaller, and they were, I don't know, ignorant is what I could call them. I saw one officer come up and just slap another guy right across the face. I don't know what the circumstances were. They had a lot of antique equipment. I don't know how they did what they did. They still had their machine guns with them little iron wheels. They would pull up in position. One guy would pull them. And they had hardly no mechanized equipment. And I remember one time we had to turn over a convoy of PWs to them. And the first thing they did, they stripped all the vehicles. They took the transmissions out, the motors out, the tires out, and they took them all back with them to Russia.
Did you... You were involved in some prisoner of war exchanges then?
Yes. We were involved with one that I wasn't too happy with. I still don't know what the hell was going on. It was men, women, and children, mostly women. And somehow or other, we had a convoy. We turned them over to the Russians. For why, I don't know.
Then you really, as in your position, what was your rank then? You were private or...?
Private, first class.
You really didn't know what was going on? I mean, you as a regular soldier, you didn't know the circumstances of why these things were happening? Or
no, we didn't know. A lot of times we didn't know.
Well, you know now what was probably going on, as you read about.
Oh yeah, since then I realized some of the things that... And then I think the Army tried to communicate even to the lowest but private.
You did?
Mm-hmm. I think they tried to tell them what was going on, what they were trying to do. But everything is, sometimes it would become so mixed up and so snafu, you'd wonder if anybody knew what the hell they were doing.
Okay. How long were you after, how long after the war was over before you came home?
I'd say we spent about 3 months in Germany, 3 or 4 months, and I came home. At that time, they were taking enlistments who wanted to go to Japan. I think about two or three out of the company, and all the officers went.
Oh, really? Okay. Did you ever meet, or did you ever come close to like you were with Patton? Did you ever see him, or what was people's impressions of him, or I mean, your soldiers when they talked about him? How did they feel about him, or?
Well. It's true, like they said, Patton's guts in our blood, because to get any objective, maybe that was the planning and strategy, but if he wanted something, he would throw everything he had into it, and he didn't care what the cost was. Blood and guts, that was a good name for him.
You never saw him, or?
One time when the war was over, he gave a speech, and I saw him then. But it was not unusual for him to roam the battlefront. We heard stories where he'd show up in the most unexpected place, riding a jeep, sitting there with his stars on, you know, and his guns. That's the kind of a person we were. I never saw him, but they say, you know, the word gets around him. That, you know,
be on guard.
Yeah, be on guard that Patton's life will be by.
What were your impressions of him at the speech then?
I thought he swore a lot, very profane. He's very egotistical. He sure was in love with Patton. And he was in love with his country. And then he would get sort of, he'd drift off in a spiritual something or other, gobbledygook that I don't know what the hell he's talking about.
Okay. Anybody else that you, that ended up being famous, as, or someone that impressed you as somebody that should have been, I mean, someone that you met like a, I mean, it could have been somebody on a lower level, you know, like people that you felt were colonels or majors or captains, anyone that impressed you, somebody that you thought was a...
Not really, no. More or less mine was a, just a day-by-day, dog-eat-dog, go over the next hill, that type of thing. We never had many personalities that we could look back to. It was more or less a common, ordinary, everyday existence. Staying alive and keeping warm.
That's what it was all about. Huh?
Yeah.
Okay, I know you probably were exposed to some officers like lieutenants that you, platoon leaders or, I mean, to start again. I know you were exposed to some officers on the platoon level. You were platoon leaders or maybe your company commanders. I mean, how did you feel about these people? Do you feel they were young or too young, or did they know their jobs, or were they learning with you, or how did you feel about those people?
Well, when we was training in Texas, we had this a regular group of officers, and they seemed like they knew what they were talking about with the maps and orientation.
And were they West Point people? Or?
No, they were mostly National Guard. That when they activated their units, they were either sergeants or top sergeants. They automatically became second lieutenant, and they weren't too bad. They generally knew what they were doing. But as we went overseas, we more or less lost most of the lower grade, like second lieutenants, first lieutenants, and captains. Then the majors and them were back in the headquarters. We never saw them anyway. Of course, they didn't have too many casualties there. And some of the lieutenants we used to get weren't all that great because they lacked combat experience. Some of them were just new from the States, and they were trying to run the war by the book, which was pretty hard to do. So we had problems there with the newer officers. I remember one time in particular, we were out on a patrol or recon mission, and I was looking across the river, and across the river I could see another German soldier, and his head popped up real slow and went back down again. We were in a house like something, and we were looking at the window, and I was going to shoot him. And the lieutenant said, "Don't shoot him, you shoot back." I said, "Well, what the hell are you going to do?" That's some of the guys we got.
Did you, that was really okay. That's funny there, but I mean, they talk about war being, you know, it's got its gruesomeness, but were there any funny, I mean, you know, can you remember any funny experiences, things were just, sometimes get so ridiculous you got to laugh at it. I mean, do you remember anything?
Another time we had to go from one CP to another, and it was at night.
CP command post?
Yeah, for something or other, he had to take a message, and, I was driving a Jeep because I knew the route. So I'm driving a Jeep, and there he's sitting over there with a BAR. And I was afraid he's going to shoot me with the goddamn BAR. He was ditching there, you know, and flinching. It was dark. It was spooky. And you could see occasional flashes or something. It was never really quiet.
So I was more afraid of him than I was of the enemy action. And of course, I think he was just fresh from the States or fresh from wherever he came from. So when I went back, I said, I ain't going with him again.
Give me somebody else.
Yeah, I'll go by myself.
Okay. Now I want to talk about, I'll talk about the enemy. Talk about him in a couple different ways. Talk about, first of all, what about the civilians that you were exposed to? Were they resentful or were they happy the war was over? How did they feel about it? What would happen?
Well, I would say the English were an admirable people.
I'll go back to that, but right now I'm talking about the German civilians that you were, when you were exposed to the civilians. Or
you mean the German civilians?
I'm talking about just the enemy people right now.
Well, the German civilians, when we got to them, they acted like they didn't know what happened or how they got in the war. They were innocent bystanders. They didn't know anything about what transpired, or they were playing a part of, it just happened. We didn't know anything about it.
I mean, they didn't look at you like, you know, the mean or
mad at you
for winning, or they just kind of ignored you and...
No, they acquiesced to the fact they were losing the war. A lot of them were hungry, malnourished, needed medical attention, no food. So in most cases, they were glad to see anybody, because maybe their villages were all torn up, no water supplies. And the army would bulldoze the road, clean it up, give them water, medical attention. I would say that civilians were cooperative, yes.
Okay. Now, about the soldiers themselves, the enemy soldiers, how did you feel about them? Did you feel like did you feel that they were fighting hard, or were they just kind of going through the motions, or?
Oh, I'd say the German soldier was top drawer. A good, efficient fighting machine. And they were so good, they could get these foreign troops, wherever they conscript them from, maybe Romania, Czechoslovakia, and they would train them, and they would fight alongside them, and they were a tremendous fighting unit. And until the German soldier, the German sergeant, was killed or something, they never quit fighting. They were wonderful soldiers. In fact, sometimes I wondered if Germany wouldn't have invaded Russia, we'd have never won the war.
I mean, if the Germans wouldn't have been tied down with the Russians?
Right, they were a good, efficient fighting machine, and they had good equipment. They had lots of it. And some of their artillery was much better than ours. Their tanks were superior to ours. It would usually take maybe two or three of our tanks to knock out one of theirs. And most of the time, it was artillery or aircraft that would get their tanks. But if we got on a one-to-one, you couldn't do it. And they were, their tanks were good, their control was good, and their firing was accurate. And the German soldier was just as good. I think we just overpowered them with sheer numbers. Sheer numbers, better equipment.
Were you ever exposed to prisoners of war, as far as like, how did they feel about, were they happy to be captured, or were they, glad that they didn't have to fight anymore, or how did they?
The few that I seen after they were captured, they became docile, and they accepted whatever PW camps they were going to, or whatever, they were going to send them, because most of them were dirty, ragged, hungry, run out of ammunition, and there was somebody behind them who was kicking their butts and making them keep them going forward. I remember one time I heard they picked up a German top sergeant, the equivalent of a top sergeant, and that son of a gun, he fought all the way back. That's how good they were. He fought all the way back. He didn't want to go. And then another instance in an infantry company, they had German PWs doing their KP.
Is there
a... Yeah, and they didn't seem to mind.
Yeah.
But they were so disciplined, they were used to taking orders. So the Americans would treat them better, so they would do KP for them.
Okay, what about their, you mentioned their equipment, but as the war was going on, toward the end, did they seem like they, or, let me, we've talked about that. Let me say, what kind of units did you exposed to? I know the Germans had, they had regular army, and then they had the SS troops. Were you, did you fight against both kind, or did you, were you, do you remember that? Were you ever exposed to any SS troops where maybe they were a little bit more, you know,
well,
they were trying to be more Nazified rather than regular Germans, or?
I don't think we ever had much contact with SS troops. They were more or less used to control civilians, army units, or something in a rear echelon. Mm-hmm. But we were just exposed to, like, their armored corps was top troops, paratroopers, and even their infantry was doggone good. Mm-hmm. They were tough, and I think the only reason started to crack when they started taking so many casualties, they had to pull more and more foreign troops into their service. And that's when they started to crack. But it was nothing unusual. We'd pull into position and you could see where these German soldiers had died right with their weapons. Right there.
Didn't go.
Didn't run back.
You felt that they were pretty well supplied and they weren't...
No, I think we'd finally defeat them with supplies, hungry, food. Then the winter was, they froze to death. They didn't have the clothes. They couldn't have. And then he ran out of gasoline. Because we could see vehicles laying that there was really nothing wrong with them. Of course, we didn't try them because you're always afraid it's going to be booby-trapped. But, you know, you go by, you could see it looked all right.
Just ran out of gas.
Mm-hmm. Just ran out of gas. Run out of ammunition, run out of gas, run out of food. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably what killed their morale more than anything.
Yeah, they were. That would be true. Well, do you have any final comments or things that do you know? Just want to wrap it up, or anything that you want to say about that you wanted to say before I stopped you, or anything that you can remember that.
Well, I was just trying to think. I think my biggest disappointment was when I seen the Russian soldiers, and I realized that we'll never get along with Russia. If that represented their best, I would hate to think what their worst was like. And the time we turned this convoy of people back to the Russians, I never felt good about that. Of course, I didn't know what happened or anything else. But it was one of my down experiences. And outside of that, right now I can't think of anything else.
Well, how did you get back?
We came back on one of Kaiser's banana boats. I think they call them Kaiser's, when it was a Kaiser's boat.
Oh, one of the captured luxury liner?
Yeah, well, Liberty. What the heck did he call them boat? Anyway, Kaiser built them. That's when he built boats. Kaiser Steel built
them. Liberty boats.
Yeah, and that's the way we came back. And we ran into a big storm, and I never was so sick in all my life. I don't think I've been on another boat ride since. This boat was short and it would waller in the waves. And the mess kitchen was right in the front of the boat, in the prow. Every time you go to the kitchen, the old boat would go poof right down in the waves.
Well, you got back when, 3 months after the war was over, so you came...
1945.
You came back, fall of 45?
Yeah.
Did you have to spend much time in camp when you came back, or did they just kind of...
I would say we spent about 2 or 3 weeks in camp.
Get processed.
Yeah, because they were processing them out as fast as they could. I'd say 3 weeks, 4 weeks, somewhere around there. But you had a lot of freedom. You could call home. And they had telephones there. I don't know, 10, 20 telephones, whatever it was. You had to wait in line to use the telephone.
I'll bet.
Yeah, to get the call home. And then you made arrangements for getting back home. Then they had to type out your, RV process. Type you out and bust you out of service.
In your home.
Yeah. I think probably one of the toughest experiences was that winter we spent in the Hurricane Forest. And then we was in the forest, and then they had these proximity shells. And they would fire these proximity shells, and as soon as they would get close to the tree or whatever, it would just splinter.
Oh, the tree would fall apart.
Yeah. And you could just hear them going through the woods. I remember one time just before we went through St. Lo, they were in we was under a mortar fire, an artillery fire, one of our lieutenants picked up a piece of shrapnel and he sliced a piece of bacon with it. That's how sharp it was. So that was always in the back of your mind. There was never a time when you was relaxed. You was always stressed, and you one ear, even when you was asleep, one ear was always open to see if you could hear any incoming mail.
So that day that they said the war was over was a pretty much of a relief then.
Yeah, we busted out the. Of course, we all had a few little something to drink. Somebody had a bottle of cognac or brandy or something that they stole from someplace else. And we built fires out in the road, even at night. Built a big fire out in the road, and everybody got around the fire, and we were talking. And it was just like they took 10 tons off your back. It was over.
Okay, and that concludes my interview for tonight. I thank you, Mr. Opencar.